Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. It's great to have you with us every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. Streaming live at richarddugan.com as we also archive the programs. We link to our guests. We'll be giving you our guest website in a little bit. We hope you'll stay with us as we have a very interesting conversation on a subject that has always been perplexing for me, because a lot of the folks that I have come in contact with over the years, and organizations and groups and so forth, many, many people, and this is just an observation, it's not a judgment, folks, they have found for themselves in an individual something that resonates with them, that serves them at the time, in regards to their philosophical and or spiritual leanings, if you will, interests and what have you. I have not. And there have been times when I have wondered, am I missing out on something? Is there something not quite right about my soul? And it's is it incomplete because I don't have an individual? Matter of fact, I guess the case in point is best summarized by a conversation I had with someone at the Christian station I worked for back in Phoenix. I was there 15 years, as I've mentioned many times. And we were chatting and chatting and da-da-da-da-da and came along and said, yo, I've been on my search since I was 17. To which they said, well, yes, but once you find Jesus, your search is over. To which I said, well, no, actually, once I find Jesus, it's just begun. And what I meant by that, of course, was that he was not the focal point of my spiritual life. The message he brought, that many have brought before him and after, was what I was searching for. And I have to say, to put it in this context, from the book Stranger in a Strange Land, there's a concept that if you've read it, you know it. That I wanted to grok into my being. I wanted to assimilate into every soul, every atom of my being. Don't know if I've done that yet. Maybe not until the day I leave this world will that happen. But be that as it may, never found a personage. I've been interested in some, followed in some of their writings, others. I talk about my primer, Paramahansa Yogananda. Well, today we're going to talk about the User's Guide to Spiritual Teachers and what that's all about with our guest, Scott Edelstein. No, Edelstein. Am I correct, Scott?
You're correct both ways.
Oh, okay.
I answered both.
Okay.
And during different times of my life, I have pronounced it either way.
I before E, except after T when it's Stein or Steen.
Well, I take both. And actually, of course, the original German would be Edelstein. I'm just, you call me Scott, please, and I'm just glad to be here.
I will do that. You are, of course, the author of the widely acclaimed Sex and the Spiritual Teacher, Why It Happens, When It's a Problem, and What We All Can Do. You're also, you're a longtime practitioner of Buddhism and Judaism, as well as a committed proponent of serious spirituality. I want to talk about that as well, in all forms and traditions. And you're in the midsection of our great country. This to me is quite intriguing, Scott, because as I stated, there, you know, I mean, I quote Paramahansa all the time. I share some of his stories as well. And I'm also quite intrigued by the Buddha. Siddhartha, which was his given name, and his realization under the Bodhi tree. I was talking about this with someone. I said, yeah, it's probably the ultimate paradox. The moment he stopped looking for enlightenment, he got it. And it's kind of like that, what is it, that Chinese finger puzzle? The more you struggle to try to get out of it, you can't get out of it. The moment you release yourself, you let go of all of the struggle to try to get out, you can free yourself.
Well, there's another paradox in the story of, you're correct, of course, his name was Siddhartha or Gautama. When there was a first name and a second name. We now call him Buddha, or even sometimes the Buddha, although the is a real misnomer because Buddha is a reference to somebody who's awake, and there's more than just one person who's ever been awake.
Right.
But he was, in fact, the star student of two spiritual teachers of his day. And in each case, they said, oh, you are sort of the golden one. You are my disciple. You will take on the mantle. You are the spiritual genius. You're the one who's to succeed me. And in both cases, Buddha said, I've learned everything I can from you. And it's not right. It's not enough. There's something missing, and went off on his own. And it was only when he ditched the spiritual teachers that he had this awakening.
Yeah.
But you can't ditch a spiritual teacher until you have one. But, so that's part of the paradox.
This is true. And of course, we are deep down inside, there's this yearning to answer those universal questions that are, you know, that are put forth many, many times, you know, who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? You know, those kinds of things. And in many instances, I love what one of my guests said many, many interviews ago. We were chatting about spirituality. We were chatting about the evolution of the species of man, Homo sapien. And I said, so do you think that our evolutionary progression is going to get to a place where we're finally going to understand who we are? To which they said, no. They said, we're going to get to a place, and I want you to expound on this as well. We're going to get to a place where we're finally going to understand who we have always been.
It's a good answer.
I liked it too. I had to think about it a little bit, but I liked it too. So share with us your thoughts in terms of your perceptions in relation, yes, to spiritual teachers, you know, because, you know, I love the analogy that we're all of us, regardless of our spiritual growth, we're walking up this ladder, okay? We're climbing a ladder, and there's someone above us, and there's someone below us. And the person below us, we reach down our hand to help them up, and we reach up to the person above us for their assistance to continue climbing the ladder.
Well, that's a common metaphor, and I think there's some merit to it. Let me give you another common metaphor that I also think there's merit to. I mean, these are all metaphors, all things made up by human beings, and by, of necessity, they can only explain sort of one aspect or one small part of the life we live. But in Judaism, life is described as a narrow bridge that we have to walk. And instead of it being a ladder that we go up, it's a bridge that we cross. Now, what we're crossing is sort of, what can I say? It's time and space creates the bridge. Our life is the bridge. We can certainly help others across that bridge. Others can help us. The bridge itself has no length. I mean, it's the length of our life, and we don't know when our life is going to end. We can't remember when it began. And the narrow bridge is sort of threading through whatever is beyond time and space. I do want to speak to two things you said, because I'm thrilled that you went straight to some essential and important questions, one of which is this notion of what do we become. I would argue that a spiritual teacher's primary job is to help each person they work with to become more of who they already are. Same kind of answer that your other guest gave. Mm-hmm. If someone tries to make you fit into the mold that they prescribe or make you just like them, something is really wrong. Yeah. They're not really teaching you. They're just trying to remake you in their image. And they're probably either a fraud or a narcissist or a sociopath or someone not to want to be around.
Now, an interesting, I don't know if I want to say paradox, but observation in regards to the period of time in which I was working at this Christian station, we were going through, and I say we, I mean the Christian community was going through a really scandalous period of 5 or 6 or even 10 years with televangelists, and the falling from grace was the term that was used. You had the Jimmy Swaggerts, and you had the Oral Roberts, and you had the Jim and Tammy Bakers, and just to name a couple. And the thought has occurred to me that even if you observed and said, I want no part of these people, there is a certain element here. And this is for someone, I think, who has progressed to this level spiritually, who can say, they may not be my guru, but they can still be a teacher to me. Mm-hmm. And I look at our current, at least as of the time of our conversation, I look at our current or elected president from 2016 mm-hmm. and say, thank you for teaching me what I don't want to emulate, mm-hmm. for showing me how I, as if I'd ever behaved in that fashion anyway. But again, it's sort of like a stark representation of, no, I don't want to go that path. I don't like it. Feels I, you know, it's like I feel like I need to go shower after I watch some of the news because I want no part of that. It is not helping. It is not productive. It pushes people away. And we've all done that in our lives. We've pushed people away. We've, you know, made, you know, those ego-centered decisions that, you know, kind of blow back on us. And we hopefully have learned from those. You know, I've managed to, I hope, stay fairly humble in my career by allowing the universe to do the humbling when I get too big for my britches. And that happened a long, long time ago. And I thank God it hasn't happened recently because I didn't get here on my own power. I got here through you and so many other people.
Well, I think you've actually touched on one of the key things to look for in a spiritual teacher, because I would argue that humility may be a central facet, not only of a good spiritual teacher, but of an adult human being. So that's if you see someone who is not humble, it means they have not had that all important. And I don't mean, what can I say? Overtly humble, like throwing themselves on the ground and wailing and putting their head into the dust and saying, I'm so small. That's not humility. I just mean a sense of what we can and cannot do in life. Mm-hmm. So if you see a spiritual teacher who doesn't seem to be humble, that is probably the single biggest red flag that something is wrong.
Right. Now, in terms of the desire mm-hmm. to have a spiritual teacher, and I'm going to mm-hmm. reference, obviously, Paramahansa here in his book, mm-hmm. in terms of his knowing mm-hmm. that he had to go out and find his guru. Mm-hmm. He was not 100% certain who it was as far as by name, but he knew that when he came upon him, he would know who it was. Mm-hmm. And so there are people who are searching for that guidance, that support, so to speak, that confirmation, mm-hmm. you know, whatever other adjectives that you want to use. So I guess, is there a, how do I put this? It seems like there's two sets of lists here. One is you run down a list for yourself of, what is it that I am looking for? What is it that I need? What is it that I feel that I've got that's going to fill that gap, that space? Mm-hmm. And the other list is, what are the characteristics of the person? Could be male or female. You know, what is it that I should be? What kind of questions maybe should I be asking of this quote unquote spiritual leader, spiritual mm-hmm. teacher? Before I begin the process of listening to them and following them, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. They're very good questions. And of course, as you suggest, they do intertwine. I want to give a pretty mundane metaphor here precisely because it's so common and so mundane. And that is, you'll talk to people who will say, oh, I want to be married or I want to have a partner, or who've been partnered for 40 years or 50 years or however long, and it feels right to them and it was something that they were always sort of inclined toward. And you meet others who have never been inclined toward that. And then you meet others who say, well, I wasn't inclined. I thought I'd be single, and then I met this person and they turned out to be right. And then there are people who said, I thought this person was just right for me, and there were things I didn't know, things I didn't understand. So it's very much the same, I would say, with spiritual teachers. So I want to first address what you said is you've never felt the need for one. You've never felt like that was a space in you that needed to be filled. That is, of course, I mean, you know this already, but I want to say it explicitly because I wrote a couple books on spiritual teachers. That is not a lack. That's not a problem. It's simply an inclination. Again, it's like sexual orientation. It's like a whole bunch of other things. That there are some people who will definitely feel drawn either toward a particular teacher or toward finding a teacher. And there are some traditions, you know, Yogananda came from a particular tradition where the, excuse me, where the finding and following of a guru is pretty typical. And actually, one of the things I talk about in both books is there are some sort of special circumstances about working with a guru, because you are, there's a kind of surrender in there that we in the West, on the one hand, we don't understand, and on the other hand, people who follow gurus don't understand an aspect of it, but we see it immediately. But I'll come back to that. So I want to make it clear, it's not one size fits all. Lots of people wake up without a spiritual teacher. Sometimes people wake up without religion. Sometimes people get stuck because of their spiritual, they have a spiritual teacher or they have the wrong one. Or as you put it, I think so eloquently, there's a space they find that they hope the spiritual teacher will fill. A good spiritual teacher will help people look at that desire and at that space. They will not fill that space. That's exactly what they will not do. But that after a certain point, that person will start to understand, you know, what is that emptiness? What's caused it? What is it doing to me or with me? How do I work with it? How do I understand it? How do I grow into it? Without running away from it or without trying to grab somebody else and stuff them into it. Mm. So it's a pretty complicated issue in one sense, to at least to talk about. But in real life, it's about simply saying, is this making me more human? Is this helping me interact with others in the world in a way that's benefiting others in the world? So there's a really kind of simple feedback loop that you can look at. If your relationship with a spiritual teacher is making you smaller, something's wrong. If it's making you larger, and by larger, I don't mean in some sort of false or imaginary way,
right?
Just more connected, more loving, more compassionate, wiser, more willing to be of service.
I find it most fascinating when I talk with, or I shouldn't say talk with, when I listen to the stories specifically about the aspect, for example, of bullying, like in school, which I had to go through, and this was years ago. I interviewed people who thought, "Oh, that's a good thing, because those kinds of things, they help build character," and I actually was at odds with that, because that seems awfully unfortunate that this individual, myself included, has to focus most of their energy on the fear and angst of just moving about the school grounds in fear of, even in the classroom, and can't focus on the process of education and learning something that maybe they might be able to put to good use down the road in their future. I find that when, you know, I've watched the televangelists over the years on TV, and I have to say I had this impression that I hoped was wrong, but when I saw for the first time on national television a preacher say, "You can even put your donation on your MasterCard or Visa, borrowing from Peter to give to Paul. It's not your money, it's his, and you're giving it to this guy over here." That was when I knew there was something seriously wrong in that realm. And it was really unfortunate, because I came in contact on the phones mostly with many of the, I'll call them the laity. Of course, that's more of a Catholic term than it is Christian per se, but just the everyday person who goes to church or goes to mass or what have you. They're hurting, they're seeking, they're trying to find their place in the world. They need help, they need support. And here's this person who says, "Go into debt to help me get," and I can't put it any other way, get wealthy.
It's a scam. Now, you mentioned bullying, because I'd like to speak to that specifically.
Yeah.
Because just today, I read some of the recent research on bullying. When you look at Anne Mastin is one of the key researchers in this area. And then when we talk about helping our kids become resilient, what we're learning now, and of course lots of people always knew, is that resilience does not reside only in the individual. So when somebody says to you or anyone that it will help you build character, well, that's only one piece of it. It may or may not help you build character, but we also need to build networks of support within a community. So one of the things that we now know is that people who are resilient aren't just kind of being little supermen and superwomen. What they are doing is enlisting the help of others around them, and the others around them are offering their help, whether it's teachers, in the case of kids, whether it's coaches, whether it's parents, whether it's relatives. So when somebody is being bullied, yes, you can stand up to a bully, and that's a good thing. But you can much better stand up to the bully if you've got your friends and classmates and relatives all standing up together. And so resiliency, I mean, you can certainly say that it can be something inherent in the individual, but it is even more so an interactive relationship among people. And I would take that analogy and move it to what we call spirituality. Like when somebody says, my spirituality, I will want to say, wait a minute, what makes you think it's yours? Spirituality, of course, we have spiritual yearnings, we have spiritual leanings, but it doesn't occur in a vacuum. It occurs with other people.
Mm-hmm.
It may or may not occur in community, but it never occurs alone. You can't be spiritual on your own. That would be something like saying eating without the food. You can't eat without food.
Mm-hmm.
Food is intrinsic to the eating. Spirituality is not something somehow lodged in an individual. It's a combination of individuals, relationships, communities, and so on.
Interesting. We're going to take a break here because I've got all these questions are flooding to the forefront of my head. By the way, I like your barber. We must go to the same one. Although I go to the car wash and get mine shined, buffed out and shined very nicely. In any event, I'm really enjoying our conversation. We're going to continue with Scott Edelstein or Edelstein, depending upon your perspective. We're talking about the User's Guide to Spiritual Teachers, as well as Sex and the Spiritual Teacher. We'll talk a little bit about that as well as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story. New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I hope that you will stay with us.
Tell me your stories.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and I am joined by Scott Edelstein for Tell Me Your Story, and we're looking for choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we're talking about the User's Guide to Spiritual Teachers, as well as some of the problems that can arise with certain spiritual teachers. I'm curious, Scott, as far as, it was funny, as you were talking and you were, you know, I'm going to say you were moderately passionate. I know you're very passionate about all of this, but you express outwardly a moderate passion. I'm curious as to how Buddhism, which seems to me to be, and I'm guessing that there's a difference between just, shall we say, straight Buddhism and Zen Buddhism. I don't know. Is there this, I get this sense that there is a sort of a happy medium, an equilibrium place within our emotions that Buddhism teaches us to be in, rather than way up here and just getting a little excited and, you know, as opposed to just kind of being down and depressed and not really wanting to be here and those kinds of things. I'm curious a little bit about if maybe you can enlighten us on the philosophy, if you will, of Buddhism.
Well, what I can do is speak to a couple different aspects of it. And I want to be clear, I'm not a spiritual teacher, and I'm not a PhD in philosophy. I'm a guy who wrote a couple of books. I do have many friends who are spiritual teachers. I'm the editor and literary agent for a number of spiritual teachers. So I'm writing this as somebody with one foot in, one foot out. I do want to kind of frame Buddhism, and that is when I started practicing Buddhism back in 1974, and Zen Buddhism, you asked about the difference between Zen and Buddhism in general. There are a lot of different ways to answer that, but Zen is the Japanese word meaning meditation or mindfulness. And so what one way of looking at Zen or Zen Buddhism is the branch or teachings of Buddhism that emphasize meditation. Sometimes it overemphasizes meditation. And by the way, meditation and mindfulness, you can use at least more or less as equals. Right now, the word mindfulness is in, the word meditation is out. But in the way it's currently used, I think we can assume that the two are equivalent. When I first got involved, meditation has been part of pretty much every major spiritual tradition, but it wanes and waxes. Times it's very prominent, other times it's not. In Judaism, for example, when I was growing up, it had been almost completely forgotten. There was a time a couple of centuries ago when it was widely practiced, and some of the best-known Jewish teachers and mystics meditated regularly, and the meditation they did was essentially the same as Zen meditation. They might have sung a Hebrew prayer beforehand, but it was at a time very common. And I was interested in meditation, and the only place at the time where I knew to look was in Buddhism. Nowadays, for example, there are two Jewish meditation centers in this country. There's one in Brooklyn and there's one in San Francisco, which was founded by a rabbi who was also a Zen teacher. He's now dead. He died a few years ago. His name is Alan Liu, L-E-W. So I do want to say that all the different traditions, I would argue, are different doors or windows into the same house. So that said, yes, of course, there are many different ways in. That said, there are some people who are only going to be able to operate one particular door or window, or who will find one door or window particularly inviting for them. So I neither want to fall into the extreme of saying there's only one way, nor do I want to say, oh, it doesn't matter which way. It matters a lot which way, but it has to be the way that works for you. And even that said, I'm going to turn it around and then I'll stop what's turned into a mini lecture. And that is that what's right for you does not necessarily mean what makes you feel good. So if in fact you're following some spiritual tradition, teaching, or path, and you're feeling bliss all the time, watch out, because something is wrong, because that's not how life is. Arguably, one of the biggest benefits of any spiritual tradition or teaching or whatnot is to help you keep your feet on the ground during the difficult and painful and unfair and dangerous and times, not just to feel good. Mm.
I am always intrigued by the teachings of the various philosophies. And I have to say some of my favorite interviews are especially with rabbis. I'm familiar enough with the process, the educational process they must go through to get to the rabbinical level. And the conversations that I've had with them have been just unbelievably enlightening, as far as even if it's the better understanding of the context, in this case of the Old Testament, the Torah. I just am amazed. I always was frustrated by the Christian position when I was working for the station back in Phoenix. How they wanted to set up a set of laws, if you will, or rules based upon Old Testament law, but they would only pick and choose. You know, there are 613 laws in the Old Testament. And the first thought that came to me was, let's see, there's a phrase I don't know if it's American civics per se, but there's a phrase regarding law that ignorance of the law is no excuse.
Indeed.
And there are thousands and thousands of laws on the books we aren't even aware of. Okay, some old ones that go back maybe to the 1700s.
Yes.
And so forth, right? And so if you get pulled over or you get stopped and you are told that you have violated thus and such laws, like, you got to be kidding me. Well, I'm sorry, but ignorance of the law is no excuse. Well, when you're talking, for example, about the Jewish laws, you can't take one without taking the other 612. And if you're ready to do that, and if you are, I applaud you, because I've read some of those.
Yeah.
And you'd be, if you're married or you have a girlfriend, yeah, once 1 week out of every month, you're going to be separated from her. Can you handle that? Now, that's just one.
She's off in the red tent.
She's off in the red tent. Yeah. Now, there is where you then start taking a look at, okay, but what was the context for this law? Mm-hmm. There are others as well. And I just found that just so intriguing. But again, we're talking about laws that apply to the physical world, the material world, not so much, although the argument or the claim would be probably made that by following these 613 laws, you are bettering your spiritual life. I think I can make that connection. So in Catholicism, you know, you have the catechism. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you have the New Testament and so on and so forth. And then the one law, you know, mm-hmm. love, the law of love. Love your neighbor mm-hmm. as yourself. Mm-hmm. And
well, let me push back on that right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, sure.
Okay? So the thing about any laws is that they're written in English. And human language is always open to dispute, to discussion, to debate. And, in fact, Jews have a practice that they call turning Torah, which is going back over the same passage over and over, often in groups, sort of arguing or putting forth or debating different interpretations. Mm-hmm. And so even though a law may seem to be simple, mm-hmm. There are, certainly in Judaism, there are rarely points of agreement. In fact, that's what the Talmud is. That's what many different Jewish books are about, is the many different interpretations. I'm going to give you one right now based on what you said.
Okay.
Love your neighbor as yourself. So what you're saying is, I can hate you, I can throw darts at you, I could wish you'd die and fall off a cliff, because you live in Santa Barbara and I live in Minneapolis. There's nowhere you could say I'm your neighbor. So as long as the person lives within half a mile of me, I need to love them like myself.
Right.
But if not, screw them. Now,
yeah.
Obviously, that is, you will say, that is not the intent. And I can come back and say, I'm just telling you what the words say in mm-hmm. the Bible.
Exactly.
So now, turning Torah is starting to go through all that. What does it mean to be a neighbor? What does it mean to love yourself? What if you don't love yourself? And so on and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And this permeates all of spiritual inquiry, and trying to kind of squish it down into something solid is never going to work, because it's always going to ooze through your fingers.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
There is one interesting conversation I had several years ago with a rabbi, and we were talking about specifically about this whole issue of the aspect of the gay lifestyle, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And now, first of all, I have to say that most people I've ever met who were gay, mm-hmm. and I have always had very good relationships with them, I never had a problem with it. I remember my best friend, who I went through grade school, high school, and college with, mm-hmm. he came out to me one day, mm-hmm. and all I could do was look at him and say, well, what do you want me to do with that? You're mm-hmm. my best friend. Well, you know, mm-hmm. it's not mm-hmm. that I don't care, mm-hmm. but I don't care, you know? Mm-hmm. But one of the laws in Leviticus has to do with, men not sleeping with men, women not sleeping with women. Mm-hmm. Well, this rabbi shared with me the context, the mm-hmm. reason why. It wasn't because it was evil or sinful for a mm-hmm. man to lay with a man. It was because the intent of the law was to prevent the interference with the reproductive and productive, if you will, process of the species.
Well, and certainly of the tribe.
And of the tribe.
This was a tribe. They didn't want to have that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, now we're in the 21st century, and there are lots of different ways to have, to bring another human life into this world. Surrogacy is one. I mean, I don't need to go down the list, but mm-hmm. I thought, wow, I wonder how many people who are vehemently opposed to this are even aware of this, which they probably aren't. Mm-hmm. But my argument always was, why is it that you, a heterosexual who is married to a woman who has umpteen numbers of children and grandchildren, whatever, how is this threatening to you personally? Personally, mm-hmm. Are you afraid that you have proclivities that might convert you? And then the other aspect, based upon a lot of the abuse that I have seen some of these people suffer, and of course they say that I didn't choose this, I was born this way. Who would choose to take on a lifestyle that would bring them abuse and violence, if not death? I mean, that just makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Any more than I chose my blindness as a kid to bring upon me the character shaping aspects of existence through the bullying. Those are some aspects of it that I've struggled with as far as trying to hopefully get other people to understand that the position against doesn't make sense if you take it personally. If you take it on your person, do you feel threatened? Do you think you have those proclivities? And again, this could apply to just about anything, you know. I've always found that fascinating.
This notion of what to do when you feel threatened, I actually think is a key aspect that I'd like to dive into for
please,
a little
Please, please.
Because we really, each of us as a human being, has to make a choice of what we're going to do when we feel threatened or scared. Of course, our lizard brain, right, there's a part of us that wants to just automatically either flee or fight or freeze or annihilate. But we also can do better than that. I mean, there are certainly times when we should flee. If a runaway truck is headed our way, we need to get the hell out of the street. So there are certainly threats that can be real. But there are other threats that are just threats to our ideas or our self-image or what we've been taught and so on. And ultimately, we either have to say, I want to explore and get comfortable with the unknown, with the uncertainty, with the fear, with the challenges. And when we do that, all kinds of things can open up in our lives. Or we do the opposite and we say, I'm going to shut down and I'm not going to get bigger. I'm going to get more curious. I'm going to get less curious, more didactic, more hard-edged, and that makes us smaller. And here's a good example of where you can see people who call themselves spiritual teachers. Some will help you grow in that way, and others will serve to shut you down, make you smaller. And that is a really essential distinction that I think each of us needs to make in our own hearts, not only when we're working with somebody, but when we're looking at a spiritual teacher and saying, is this person worth listening to or following?
I am always intrigued by folks in, you know, investigations and research into some of these things, and I'm encouraging that. That's the reason why we do this program, because we're trying to lay out onto the table a smorgasbord of different ideas and what have you to consider, and it's kind of like what you were talking about before when you're searching for a spiritual leader. If it resonates with you, check it out. You know, and in one sense, what have you got to lose? You can always say, no one, nothing to do with it. No, thank you.
But what you've done, Richard, is all important, which is you've put forward both parts to it. And many people only do one. If you don't mind, I would like to unpack what you've said, because it's actually quite profound. The first is, when you feel a pull toward someone, that is a good reason to explore it further. It is not a good reason to throw yourself at that person's feet. Or to just say, this person is the one, I will do whatever they say, I will follow them. And that's true whether it's a relationship with a spiritual teacher or a romantic relationship. So when you feel that pull, that means, all right, spend a little more time with this person, but take it slow, take it careful, watch what the person says and does, watch what the people around them say and do, watch yourself. And if it feels right, this is the key thing. When something feels right, that usually means one of two things. Either it is right, at least for now, or it's very wrong. What you're feeling is the familiarity of something that's going to recreate a traumatic event or an abusive relationship or something that you are used to but is not good for you. And so that feeling, oh, this person is right, that you very much feel viscerally in your body, that is, as you just suggested, a good reason to take one step forward and then to stop and to examine and investigate more. Somebody who feels right at the beginning if they are authentic and if they're the real McCoy and if they resonate with you, they will also feel right a month later, 2 months later, 5 months later. If it's someone who's abusive or narcissistic or sociopathic or predatory or just a plain fraud, it will feel great for the first month or two, and then it'll start to feel darker and darker and darker.
Mm. Well, I'm always, as I said, I'm always intrigued, and this is for me great fun. I joke with people, yeah, these interviews, this show, that's my therapy. but I'm learning too, just like everyone else, and it's intriguing how people come to the space and the place that they are, and then it's also just as intriguing when they realize, I'm not really enjoying this place and space that I'm in. I need to move from here, but sometimes they find it very difficult to do. And sometimes we do need that other person. I love, and maybe we can talk a little bit about this. I love what James Redfield said in his Celestine Prophecy about how we each have messages for the other. Mm-hmm. And I take it to the next level and say, and then when we put up our shields, okay, our messages cannot get out and their messages can't get in. And now we're denying ourselves of a message that could help us to add another piece to the puzzle of our big picture. We're also denying the other person that same ability to put another piece of their puzzle together, which is kind of what we're doing in this instance here. We're trying to understand, again, going back to those big mm-hmm. questions that we brought up at the beginning of the program. Who am I? What am I doing here? Where have I been? Where am I going?
I would reframe Redfield's metaphor of the shield, because we need shields.
Sure. No.
The problem is when we use a shield when we don't need it.
Right.
Because a hand can hold a shield. A hand can hold a sword. We definitely have times where we need the sword and times when we need a shield. But a hand can also point in the right direction, and it can hug someone, pull someone closer in a hug, and it can support someone as they walk forward. And the trick is to learn to use the hands properly, including the shield and the hug and all those different things in the right ways at the right times.
And that would seem to me to bring on the aspect of discernment, which would draw in the aspect of possibly of our own intuition. Talk to me about that aspect of it, especially when it comes to if we're searching for a spiritual teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would argue that these two books are both essentially, and they talk, pardon me, they talk about all kinds of different topics, but ultimately they're all about building your own discernment. Because whether a spiritual teacher is valuable or fraudulent, they will almost always have followers. There'll always be people who will say good and bad things about any particular teacher. They may have their own agendas. And ultimately, you need to make your own decisions. Yes, you need to follow pay attention to your gut, but you also need to pay attention to your heart and to your head. I mean, that's why we have all three. Mm-hmm. And if that's too metaphorical for you, I don't mean in particular, I mean for the listener, mm-hmm. we now know that all those three things I'm talking about are medically called the vagus nerve, V-A-G-U-S, that winds around our innards, that goes around the heart when you feel something in the pit of your stomach. There's a whole bunch of things that are all the vagus nerve. So when we talk about the head, the heart, and the body or the gut, of course, the body-mind is all one thing, and it's not even a thing because it connects with the whole rest of the universe. But we need to pay attention to all those aspects of ourselves. And here's the other interesting thing. If you find that your intuition is telling you something different from what a spiritual teacher tells you, I would argue you still need to follow the intuition for two reasons. One is you might make a mistake. That's fine. We can all learn from our mistakes, but when we go against ourselves, then we put ourselves in just an impossible situation. We can certainly put ourselves in a place where we have this enormous regret. Why didn't I listen to myself? Mm. And ultimately, we need to. And we need to get better about how we listen to ourselves, and we'll even learn that if we listen to ourselves and then make a mistake. But if ever we're put in a situation by a spiritual teacher who says, don't listen to yourself, listen to me, it's time to run away, because that forces you into the position of either no longer listening to yourself and giving yourself up to the teacher, body, soul, they can do whatever they want to with you, which is seriously bad news, or and then you're kind of stuck. So you have to ultimately follow your intuition. And this isn't just true of spiritual teachers. I left my urologist because I had prostate cancer a few years ago, and I started taking a supplement that was supposed to help, and the cancer went away. And my urologist said, no, it didn't. That can't have happened. You can't be better. You're wrong. Well, it's my body. The cancer's gone away. It's been tested twice. And when I stop taking the pills, the symptoms come back. And when I take the pills again, it starts to go away. The urologist says, no, I don't know. It must be the placebo effect. Well, what am I going to do? I'm not going to stop taking the damn supplement. I'm going to find a new urologist. Same for spiritual teachers.
By the way, I find it fascinating that the doctor is denying medical science that he is up to his eyeballs in, yeah, when you come to him and say, hey, it's been tested twice at two different labs, and it's not there. And by the way, I saw a report not long ago on just how incredibly effective the placebo effect can be. It's just unbelievable. And what's really fascinating about that report I saw, the individuals who were taking the placebo knew that they were taking the placebo, and it still helped.
That gets into a whole other issue.
And, before I let you go again, of course, thank you for joining us here on the program. Scott, who's the author of The User's Guide to Spiritual Teachers, as well as Sex and the Spiritual Teacher. I encourage you to go to his website, scottedelstein.com. And before I let you go, Scott, three final questions very quickly here, because I know we're short on time. First of all, who is Scott Edelstein?
When Gautama, the guy we call the Buddha, was asked that same question, he answered, depending on how you translate it, stream or streaming. But of course, he wasn't just answering that about himself. He was answering that in terms of every human being and the whole world. We are not these settled things bumping about in the world. We are all streams of energy and consciousness and relationship and interactivity. So that would be my answer to who is Scott Edelstein. That would be my answer to who is Richard Dugan. That would be my answer is who is the person listening to this discussion right now.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I hope people will just be safer, and I hope people that people will not turn away from their spiritual leanings because they get hurt or because they make mistakes. And I basically, I have one last thing then, if I may, is that I would argue that the most serious threat to human life, human beings, human happiness on this planet is what psychologists call personality disorders. Now, you don't have to look at it through a psychological lens. You can look at it through other lenses. My friend Bill Eddy has a book coming out shortly called The Five Types of People Who Can Ruin Your Life. And you could call those personality disorders, narcissism, sociopathy, borderline, etc. You can call them lots of other things, and they happen in our relationships. And one of the things that I'm hoping to do here is to help people not get taken in by folks claiming to be spiritual teachers who have one of those personality disorders. And I'm hoping that people will build their own discernment and will grow into themselves. So those are my hopes.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Oh, you can ask me that on my deathbed, because it's something that I think we need to, I don't think we look forward at it. I think we look back at what it has been, because there are many things I've tried to do in my life. Some have succeeded, many have failed and instead led me in other directions. And now I'm 62 and I've come to understand that it's not my job to set a goal and fulfill it. It's my job to live into the next moment with as much presence and love and caring and compassion and wisdom as I can.
Scott Edelstein, again, thank you so much. Author of The User's Guide to Spiritual Teachers and Other Things as well. And we encourage you to check out his website, scottedelstein.com. Again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Richard. It's been a great pleasure.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.
But I will add, in America only, which, and no one's been able to explain this, the more expensive the placebo, the more effective it is.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because here in wine country, they've done tests where they've done blind taste tests with high-end and low-end wines. And when they don't know what the cost of the wine is, they invariably select the lower-end wine. You know, it's like, okay, you know, I'm not real thrilled with paying $20 for a bottle of fermented grape juice. You know, I'll go and get a bottle of Welch's and leave it out on the counter for a couple of weeks, and then we'll see what we've got. And then you try that and tell me what you think. I know that's an extreme example, but it is kind of funny, and you're absolutely right. That's one of the reasons why I've always loved Chinese medicine. Been around for more than 5,000 years. There was never an FDA. They just knew that it worked. They just knew. And that's something that I have often found so incredible. This is quite an extraordinary set of books you've got, and the work that you're doing. Again, the book is entitled "The User's Guide to Spiritual Teachers." He's also Scott Edelstein has also written Sex and the Spiritual Teacher. I want you to check out his website, which obviously is his name, scottedelstein.com, scottedelstein.com. And you can check out the work that he's doing, get in touch with him through the website, and also order a copy of the book or books that you are interested in. A wise and practical self, a quick start guide for anyone who wants or already has a spiritual teacher. And I have to say that I can't remember exactly what it was that I was watching at the time, but I found it very interesting that some of the spiritual, quote-unquote, spiritual teachers that have come and gone who promoted, if you will, a philosophy that ended in, quite honestly, in what would then be classified as the demise of the cult. I mean, the complete... it was a murder suicide pact, if you will. I mean, I know that it was going on long before Jim Jones in Guyana, but I vaguely remember that. But I've gone back and I've seen a couple of documentaries, which I remember how sick I felt when I started hearing the news coming out, and then of course I'm watching the documentaries and relived that sickness, if you will. The other cult focused on the comet Hale-Bopp.
Yeah,
you know, and that particular group, and there are probably groups all over the world that are still doing this kind of thing, where they will fixate on a particular date or an astronomical event. Of course, we are not hearing about it because our news is filled with other things right now. But it's one of those things that when you start looking at it, and you wonder, how could these people, you know, what was it that was missing in their and I put it this way, in their intellect, or maybe in their intuition, in the vagus nerve, if you will, that didn't let them know that something wasn't right here? Or did they override that by saying, no, I need this community? I mean, I've experienced that to this degree. I became a member of the Baha'i faith for a year and a half back in the mid-90s. And
you're
at the end...
A lot worse than be a Baha'i.
I'm sorry?
You could do a lot worse.
Well, it was funny because when I finally realized after a year and a half, now I had not become officially, but I was attending the events and so forth and attending the firesides and the discussions and having a great time at it. Mm-hmm. I finally realized I couldn't take the final step because I had joined under what I perceived of as false pretenses. I was looking for a community of acceptance, not looking for the next level in my spiritual growth. And I didn't feel that that was fair. Now, the real funny thing was, early in this phase, I wrote a letter, so to speak, of resignation to the Catholic Church, took it to the rectory, and their response, I chuckle to this day about the response. They said, "We'll put it in your file." To which I responded, you and the FBI have a file on me? I thought, okay. So that's that, and that was very interesting. But I was so intrigued by what was being taught. But then the comment was made about my questioning reading other materials outside of those of the founder and other members of the faith over the century. They said, no, you can read whatever you want, but I will tell you that it will eventually wind up coming all right back around to these writings. And I thought, I don't see how that's possible. I can see the linkage, but bringing it back around, I don't know, you know. And so that was a very interesting process. But again, I wonder how it is that I wonder if this is a strictly an American problem, or does this actually
very much though the world and the history of religion. You raised actually two things here. One is the need to belong, and the other is the visions of the end of the world. And the need to belong is arguably, some people would say it is the strongest of human desires, stronger than the desire to eat, stronger than the desire to have sex, stronger than the desire to live. And so that belonging is very much wrapped up with any questions of spirituality and community and learning. And it is no accident that Jesus and Gautama, the guy we call Buddha, both had to go out into the middle of nowhere and completely not belong to discover that they had always belonged in a way that and that we all have always belonged in a way that surpasses any human notion about it. The other thing I would say is that visions of the end of the world are as old as religion, and that people are always having those. And I think we've got two very good reasons for it. One is because our world will always end, because we know we're going to die. And the other is that the world is always ending. Every moment, the world disappears and a new, different world reappears. And that scares the hell out of people. And they hope to be able to keep the world from doing that. And if there's one thing that we know is not the case, is that the world will not hold still. It's always changing. It's a new world every moment. And our job is to live into it, not try to hold it into something static and hold ourselves into something equally static.
That's why I've always loved REM's "It's the End of the World." And you know, it's the end of the world as we know it. I can't go back to my hometown of Phoenix, Arizona, because it doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Which is sad in one sense, because boy, we had some great times back when I was a kid. But
what's the name of the town, Richard? It's Phoenix. It's about the bird that rises from its own ashes. Of course, it couldn't possibly be the same. Even in its name, it tells you that it's gone.
That's true. That's true. Good point. Good point. But it is something that there was a book that came out many years ago, and my boss at the religious station, he had us all read. It was mandatory. It wasn't the Bible, folks. It was actually another book, which I found very fascinating when I did read it. It was called "Who Moved the Cheese?"
Oh, yes.
I read the book, and I said, okay, look, I read the book, I get the concept, and I don't have a problem with somebody moving the cheese, okay? I don't. I have a problem with them not telling me that they moved the cheese. Tell me that you're moving the cheese and where you moved it to. If you want to move it, that's fine. And that's what's always troubled me over the years. And yet it kind of goes back to that old saying about in school, you know, in kindergarten, you are going to learn that when you're done playing with your toys, you put them back where you got them. Well, you know, as an adult, we just don't seem to want to do that. So I have to, there are times when I have to ask my wife, so where is this thing that I'm looking for? Oh, it's over there. And I want to respond with, well, but that's not where I left it, because that does absolutely no good. And then, of course, just creates more problems. I just, okay, thank you. And I will go get it where she told me it was. And we're done.
Actually, that's a profoundly spiritual question if you really unpack it and dig into it. Because what we're all faced with in life is we take what we've learned, our experience, our knowledge, our skills, and we apply it to the next moment. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it fails dramatically.
Yeah.
Then we're kind of going, wait a minute, I thought I had this deal with God that if I did X, Y is going to happen. And there are no such deals.
Yeah.
World is fresh and new, and we may not know how to deal with it, and we can only learn anew.
I was reading a book about how brain power, how to utilize the other 90% of your brain. Mm-hmm. And this was back in, I think, the late 80s, early 90s. And there were these equations. And the first equation was a series of letters. And they were like A, B, E, G, M, O, and so forth. And you had to find the pattern. Well, my gosh, the pattern just, it screamed at me. Every odd-numbered positioned letter, they were all straight lines. And every even-numbered positioned letter, there were curved lines, right? All right, next equation. All right, now you have a series of numbers. And it was like 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8, and 11. And I sat there and I grabbed my calculator and I'm trying to figure out what the pattern is. And I go to the back of the book and it kind of goes to what you were just saying. The answer was exactly the same as the first equation. The first, the even numbered positioned numbers were straight lines and the odd numbered position numbers were curved. And, you know, and so it's like, okay, I should not have thrown out that answer. I should have held on to it, you know, until I was finished. But you're right. It is what we tend to do. And this is why it is always fascinating to me, not only after what we went through in our political cycle in 2016, but also what I keep hearing from people when they talk about the stock market or different things of this nature, where I remember in 2008, when we went through that economic downturn, they called it a recession. And the solutions that they were, first of all, they said, we've never been here before. This is, okay? All right?
That's what they always say just at the beginning of a recession or a depression.
Right. But this was so strange. This was so bizarre that we've never been here for. Okay? And yet, they were beginning the process of incorporating or instituting solutions that they had used before.
Exactly.
And I'm going, well, wait a minute. If you've never been down this road before, how can you use the same solutions for the problem that was back down the road in this situation that you've never been here before to solve? Now, granted, my example of the first equation and the second equation had the same solution, but apparently there are now reports here in the 20-teens that we're doing the same thing again, making the same mistakes that are going to create the same problem from 2008.
That's right.
And it's like, wait a minute, but I thought the solutions that you put into place in 2008 and 2009 were supposed to take care of this. Well, that's because human nature wasn't fixed, if you will. We didn't learn. We didn't take in the education. We didn't grok the information. And
human nature isn't fixed in either way, either fixed as in repaired or fixed as in something static and unchangeable.
Yeah. I mean, it's constant. It's in a dynamic mode.
Yes.
You know,
and so is the stock market, right? The economy is itself a dynamic system.
However, there's an element to it that I always point to with people when they like, for example, one day after some news broke, it dropped 300 points.
Right.
And then it started to inch back up again. Then over the next few days, mm-hmm. and I said, wait a minute, I want you to take a look at a graph. You know, go to Google if you want. Show me a graph of the stock market's progression from the beginning of the stock market to the mm-hmm. present day. Mm-hmm. And when you pull that up, there is only one direction that it goes mm-hmm. from a distance mm-hmm. up. Mm-hmm. Now, it has had its dips, like in 29 and, of course, 2008 and so forth. But it's always gone up. Mm-hmm. And it's like, relax. Relax. I'm curious, shifting gears here a little bit, speaking of going up, evolution of man, mm-hmm. how do you see it? What do you see it as over, say, the next 50 or 100 years? Or are we going to just be playing the same silly games that we're playing today that we played in the 90s and in the 70s mm-hmm. and so forth and so on?
Well, actually, I will give you an answer in relation to spiritual teachers. And that is, if a spiritual teacher says that they are about helping either humanity or you evolve, I have noticed they're almost always a fraud or they have a personality disorder. period. I cannot name one person who talks in those terms who has not either abused and exploited people or had a terrible flame out. Or been under arrest, or led a cult. And I'm not sure I know why, but I'm just going to take a guess. And I want everyone who's hearing me to understand it's just a somewhat educated guess. It's that people who hope to evolve, as opposed to just be more themselves and just be more human, you can't hope to evolve into something better unless you're deeply dissatisfied with who you are. Mm. And I don't mean necessarily in terms of you in particular. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be that. It could be that somehow you feel like you're second rate. But it can also just be a sense of disgust with the whole human race. But either way, that makes you an easy mark for a fraud or a narcissist or just an outright crazy person who says, oh, I know, and this is what sociopaths in particular do. They look for what it is you're looking for. They observe you until they put their finger on what you're trying to find, whether it's belonging, whether it's a sense of purpose, whether it's answers, and whatever it is, then they come to you and say, ah, that's what you're looking for, and I have it. And guess what? I will provide it to you eventually, if you do what I say, or follow my advice, or have sex with me, or you know, or give me all your money, whatever it is. And so I have no idea what human beings are evolving into, nor do I think that, I mean, this is something that you look at after the fact. No one says, I'm going to evolve into X, Y, or Z. I mean, that's certainly not how evolution works. When I put antifungal on my toes, on my toenails, which have a toenail fungus. The organisms there, the ones that can't adapt die, and the ones that adapt live on and then recolonize the toenails. That's how evolution works. Evolution is not about people thinking we're now going to evolve in this direction. So I'm deeply skeptical of any discourse that's looking into the future about evolution. So that's my take on it. Not that we don't evolve, perhaps, but that it's something to be talked about. It's all that would be all kind of just making up stories.
Yeah, I certainly understand that. It is to me very interesting how, again, people they get caught up.
They do.
In these kinds of things. And I do my utmost to be as respectful as I can in saying some of the things that I do on this program. And I do say this with respect, but frustration at the same time, mm-hmm. especially with those who buy into the whole, you know, the whole rapture mentality, mm-hmm. because to me, that's escapism. It's like, well, what are you afraid of here that you yeah. don't want to be here anymore, that yeah. you expect God mm-hmm. to carry out this physical carrying away of the saints, which, mm-hmm. I just don't, because to me, that's like, oh, well, what about the people you're leaving behind? Don't you care what happens to them? Don't you want to help them to move forward as well? You know, because see, rapture seems to be somewhat of a selfish, self-centered Indeed. Kind of concept.
Indeed. And some people treat salvation that way, too.
Yeah.
First of course, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been a great pleasure.
I have thoroughly enjoyed it. Before I let you go, again, of course, thank you for joining us here on the program. Scott, who's the author of The User's Guide to Spiritual Teachers, as well as Sex and the Spiritual Teacher. I encourage you to go to his website, scottedelstein.com. And before I let you go, Scott, three final questions very quickly here, because I know Please. We're short on time. First of all, who is Scott Edelstein?
When Gautama, the guy we call the Buddha, was asked that same question, he answered, depending on how you translate it, stream or streaming. But of course, he wasn't just answering that about himself. He was answering that in terms of every human being and the whole world. We are not these settled things bumping about in the world. We are all streams of energy and consciousness and relationship and interactivity. So that would be my answer to who is Scott Edelstein. That would be my answer to who is Richard Dugan. That would be my answer is who is the person listening to this discussion right now.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I hope people will just be safer, and I hope people that people will not turn away from their spiritual leanings because they get hurt or because they make mistakes. And I have one last thing then, if I may, is that I would argue that the most serious threat to human life, human beings, human happiness on this planet is what psychologists call personality disorders. Now, you don't have to look at it through a psychological lens. You can look at it through other lenses. My friend Bill Eddy has a book coming out shortly called The Five Types of People Who Can Ruin Your Life. And you could call those personality disorders, narcissism, sociopathy, borderline, etc. You can call them lots of other things, and they happen in our relationships. And one of the things that I'm hoping to do here is to help people not get taken in by folks claiming to be spiritual teachers who have one of those personality disorders. And I'm hoping that people will build their own discernment and will grow into themselves. So those are my hopes.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Oh, you can ask me that on my deathbed, because it's something that I think we need to, I don't think we look forward at it. I think we look back at what it has been, because there are many things I've tried to do in my life. Some have succeeded. Many have failed and instead led me in other directions. And now I'm 62, and I've come to understand that it's not my job to set a goal and fulfill it. It's my job to live into the next moment with as much presence and love and caring and compassion and wisdom as I can.
Scott Edelstein, again, thank you so much. Author of The User's Guide to Spiritual Teachers and other things as well. And we encourage you to check out his website, scottedelstein.com. Again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Richard. It's been a great pleasure.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.